Hi, can we make a start? Is the microphone on? People here. I'm Kate Mallison. I'm chairing tonight's session on terrorism, morality and human rights, organised by the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. It's a very timely moment for us to be thinking about this subject, and I'm delighted to have two such experienced and knowledgeable speakers. I'll be very brief in my introductory comments so as to allow them plenty of time. I'm delighted to welcome Ravinder Singh from Matrix Chambers. I'm particularly delighted because he's just taken up a post here as visiting professor of law with a close association with the centre. He's of course a leading member of the bar in the area of public law and human rights. He took Silk last year, and he's appeared in many of the leading Human Rights Act cases, of course, including the challenge to the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act, which is a subject he's going to talk about this evening. He's also published widely in the area of human rights. His book, The Future of Human Rights in the UK, was published in 1997, and he has a new text, which he's co-editing, on the impact of the Human Rights Act, which is out this summer. This is his first contribution to the centre's events, and we very much hope it's going to be the first of many, particularly in light of his new position. I shall say even less about Conor Gearty. It would be impossible to be interested in human rights law in the UK and terrorism in particular without having been influenced by his extensive work in the area, and we're extremely lucky to have lured him away from across the Aldwych from King's in September to come and take up the chair of human rights law here and to take up the post of director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. It's hard to believe that he's only been here a term because his dynamism and his enthusiasm has already had such an impact on the centre. I think we knew as soon as he arrived that he hadn't left his radicalism across the road, because one of the first things that he did when arriving in complete breach of LSE protocol was to make an absolutely unprecedented demand for some wonderful primary colours to be painted on the walls of the new centre, and I don't know if the LSE will ever recover from that. I'm told that our speakers will speak for about 30 minutes each, leaving 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes for questions, and then there will be drinks in the Robinson Room at the third floor at about 7:30. So I understand that Conor's going to go first.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kate, for that wonderful introduction, which already has excited people to ring in. It's like an interactive LSE. We won't take any questions from the hall. We'll take them from video texts flashing onto this. Yes, the colours, radicalism. When you get to be middle-aged and conservative, and yet you have a radical past, you divert all your radical energies into something completely irrelevant, like walls. And bearing in mind that the first question at my interview for this job was from a very distinguished professor in Oxford, maybe cut quite to the core issue before we move on. You've opposed the Human Rights Act for some years. Why are you applying for this job? From a very radical perspective. So I'm concentrating on walls as I make my peace with the Human Rights Act. The more I look into the Human Rights Act, the more I think it's presenting a very sophisticated response to the challenge of reconciling respect for human dignity, democracy, and the rule of law with the exigencies of the democratic process. And I think that's what tonight is about, because we're talking, it might be thought, yet again, the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, about terrorism and human rights. We've had Hina Jilani give a riveting talk last December. We had at a seminar Professor Noam Chomsky from MIT addressing the same issue. We're having a further discussion about Guantanamo next month, but there's no apologies for that. We have other areas. We have Albie Sachs coming. We have a concentration on social and economic rights and other important issues later. But this is the core challenge for people who say they believe in human rights. How do you reconcile and deepen, I would say, your commitment to human rights in all the noise generated by the counter-terrorist state? Because the subject forces us all, in the context of this terrorism thing, forces us to ask quite serious questions about what is meant by human rights. Very easy to agree among ourselves about their importance. Very easy to assume a kind of moral superiority based on this shared commitment to something which, when we share it in our bland and complacent way, seems rather exclusive. We need to do more than that. The challenge of counter-terrorism, not the challenge of terrorism. To say we live in a terrorist age is to miss the point. We live in a counter-terrorist age. Forces to the surface to try and meet that challenge. An obligation to articulate what human rights means. And I think it means three things. And the challenge to them has always been ongoing and will continue. Just taken a new form. Those three things are terribly straightforward. Firstly, it requires us to see people, to see each person, to respect the dignity of the person, to recognize that they are people. Once you begin to see a person as other than a person, whether because of their gender, because of their race, or because of their sexual orientation, or because of where they have come from, you cease to regard them as worthy of human rights. So if you have performed the trick of rendering invisible people around you, you can, with total consistency, call for their removal from the country in order to guarantee their torture and possible death, whilst maintaining and protesting an ongoing commitment to human rights. It is merely that you have excluded persons from your range of vision. That's the first thing that human rights is about, forcing us all to see that we are all human, and not just some of us, those of us like us. And that's a very challenging thing. But secondly, and here's residues of my old radicalism is a grand word, now diverted into the colours of walls. And the walls are, if I may say so in an aside, excellent. Green is always an excellent colour, I think. Second is a commitment to representative democracy. Human rights is not in opposition to representative democracy. Human rights is epitomised by a properly functioning representative democracy. One of the problems that has arisen in the subject is that it has overdeveloped in the legal sphere and underdeveloped in the political sphere. And the result is that, for example, such basic, brilliant human rights instincts as the right to vote, which is, after all, the clearest guarantor that people exist that we have available to us, and therefore the clearest affirmation of human rights, is not in some ways seen as a human right or a primary human right, whereas in many ways it's the key human right. And thirdly, apart from respect for human dignity and the principle of representative government, human rights stands for the idea of the rule of law. Respect for legality. The idea of government by law. These three combine together to provide a positive vision of humanity, which is one that has long historical roots in our society, which traces its way to radicals way back in the 17th century, a commitment to these three. And it's always been a tough fight, always opposed. Human rights is not a new subject. The people who claim that they are human rights persons today are, insofar as they understand their subject, in a long and noble historical tradition. But it's a tradition that's always been challenged. In the old days, it was explicitly challenged. Black people are not persons. Women are not persons. Workers are not persons. And gradually, we secured the universal franchise. But in the 20th century, the challenges were rooted in language familiar to us today, the language of national security, the language of the hot wars of World War I and World War II, and the language of the Cold Wars, of the Red Scare of the 1920s, the Cold War from 1948, and the McCarthyism that was rampant in the United States, which we have echoes today, and which to some extent bit into this culture as well. Now, before the 11th of September 2001, there was undoubtedly a new set of challenges emerging to this positive vision of humanity that the language of human rights suggests. And they were to be found in each of these three areas. As regards human dignity, there was before the 11th of September a beginnings of a rejection of the humanity of the other, of persons outside our sphere. The language took the form of a concentration on the bogus asylum seeker. The language then did not permit the belief that even non-bogus asylum seekers should be returned to torture and death. But the language revolved itself around the language of the liar, the cheat, and the criminal. That was evident well before the 11th September. But evident also was the collapse might be too strong a word, but by the serious erosion of competence in democratic structures, facilitated, of course, by globalization, but a kind of uninformed apathy, which is the absolute supporter of the right and of reactionary forces everywhere, a kind of cynicism. People who are cynical about politics do not realize that that is identical to being extremely right-wing. Right-wing people who reject the language of human rights, reject the humanity of everybody around them, political observation, feed off the cynicism of the community. And thirdly, you had, well before the 11th September, you had a kind of creeping quasi-democratic authoritarianism in the Western community. You had laws which were fought over bitterly because of their quasi-authoritarian implications in the 1980s, battles fought over laws like the Public Order Act, the Interception of Communication Act, and the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which battles now look like liberal jousts on the margins of more serious invasions of freedom and liberty. The point of making these observations about the time before the 11th of September is to be clear that the 11th of September can only be a turning point if it is building on movement in a certain direction. No single event, however catastrophic, can transform an atmosphere without that atmosphere having begun in certain ways to turn. And what we've seen since then is a much more frontal assault on the visibility of the person. A much more, if you want, kind of honest assertion by people, as I indicated before, that it doesn't matter whether persons who make these shores are or are not going to be persecuted on their return or killed or tortured. We don't want them. That is an explicit recognition of their invisibility as persons. And the enemy within, to use a phrase from the 1980s, from which a lot of this quasi-democratic authoritarianism emerges, the enemy within is not only any longer the asylum seeker within the state who, in the words of many politicians, should be locked up pending their removal. The enemy within has now spread, and the enemy within are people who do not subscribe to certain values, but not by reference to their person, but by reference to their category. This is a very dangerous development, because the stereotypification of a person is the route towards the rendering of them as invisible. Now, I made a joke about the Green, and some of you may have detected from that I happen to be from the Republic of Ireland. I've spent 20 years trying to, I haven't really, actually. But the Irish could tell you a thing or two about this from the 1970s, when it was difficult in this country to be Irish without being perceived to be part of an entity desirous of destroying the state. It's a very tricky position for a community or communities to find itself in, and that didn't have the impetus behind it of the developments that I've identified since. But secondly, and seriously, not only is there this explicit rejection of the respect for human dignity, there's also a most extraordinary elite sense in which democracy is no longer that relevant. You don't need to name countries. Places that deliver certain outcomes are regarded as immune from criticism regardless of their democratic or non-democratic structures. Certain countries that might be tentative about supporting great world powers find articles in the New York Times about their lack of democratic deficit or their lack of democratic structures, and when they change their policy and facilitate the expansion of power, they might find those articles stopping. Meanwhile, other countries with democratically elected and very popular presidents find themselves, in an almost casual way, the victims of certainly internationally supported, if not internationally inspired, internal subversion. And you see this also in an increased lack of any anxiety about democratic accountability in the development of domestic law, both in this country and in other European countries, but particularly, of course, in the United States, where executive orders have now dominated the civil libertarian agenda in a way that would have been unthinkable under, for example, a president who now looks progressive, Richard Nixon. And that last point, and that's serious, he was, you know, compared to what's happening now, quite a progressive guy. That last point feeds into this subversion of the rule of law. It's not just the rejection of an international rule of law. And it's interesting how shaky is the commitment to an international criminal court, that it could be a serious issue to discuss now, the facilitating of the exiting from Iraq of President Saddam Hussein, as though there were no sort of international code to which the man could or should be subject. But there's the domestic departure from the rule of law, which is equally worrying, reflected in, for example, in one country, a recognition of the legitimacy of the shoot to kill by executive order, not this jurisdiction. But in this jurisdiction, extensive increases in surveillance powers and also detention powers. Now, there's three new elements to the post-September 11, which are together, I think, providing huge challenges, which are potentially explosive. The first, obviously, is that there is no way in which the current crisis can end. This is extremely convenient to government. Governments have been notoriously reluctant to end wars. Indeed, the World War I didn't end until about 1921. They passed a special piece of legislation saying this goes on as long as we want it to go on. But sooner or later, you have to notice it's over. Similarly, to his great credit, the then Prime Minister Winston Churchill lost no time, unusually, in drawing an end to World War II in terms of the disbanding of the emergency powers legislation, apart from the ration. The Cold War took a while to end, but in the end, not even the American hawks could claim that the collapsed Russia posed a threat. The beauty of this war, and the particular nature of the challenge facing the language of human rights, is that it has no method whereby it can end. The enemy does not need to act to maintain the war. The absence of action is sufficient in itself to underpin the ongoing counter-terrorist campaign because of the threat of action. What is always implicit in the counter-terrorist world has finally come true, which is the switch of attention from what has happened to what might happen. And once the counter-terrorist has persuaded public opinion to root its law on the basis of dismal hypothesis rather than on actual fact, then the whole world is its repressive oyster, because anything might happen. It is impossible to contradict a political argument from a politically elected representative who represents, for example, the Home Department, that X, Y, or Z might happen, and they are so terrible that A, B, and C must be enacted to prevent it. There is no empirical weapon with which to respond. And secondly, apart from this never-ending nature of this current war, there is real anxiety about the very sharp decline in living standards in the West. Anxieties about recession, anxieties about economic prosperity, anxiety about fear like this in a climate of declining standards. Liberalism is sometimes linked to comfort, and the corollary of that might be that the liberal atmosphere is challenged also by anxieties about work, anxieties about family security, and that's particularly the case in the moment in the United States of America, it seems to me. Thirdly, very serious global and environmental challenges, which are going to produce catastrophic challenges to human rights, which are at the moment incapable of being responded to by a coherent international political system. Now, where does the language of human rights fit into this rather dismal picture? Well, the language of human rights, historically rooted, as I've expressed, is a language which is rooted in this benevolent approach to humanity. And therefore, where counterterrorism is in the front line of the assault, taking the place of fear of war and of Cold War, so human rights is in the front line of the reaction by the forces of the good. And what's essential is that the language of human rights should be focused and should be targeted and should not be vague and waffly, because that allows it to be discounted. Now, Ravinder Singh is going to talk about the human rights side of this discussion. The nature of the topic is about terrorism and morality as well. And what I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes or so doing is suggesting that we should together, as part of our commitment to the rule of law, human dignity, and respect for democratic processes, really challenge the language of terrorism. Because people are getting away with far too much, far too easily. For example, surely a relationship between terrorism and morality, any analysis of it, must start with careful consideration of what is meant by terrorism. And let's approach the subject in a structured kind of way. What it intuitively and uncontroversially suggests to us is, in its contemporary usage, the deliberate or reckless killing of civilians, or the doing of extensive damage to their property with the intention of communicating a political message of some sort, usually but not necessarily a government. Seems to me that'll get you quite a long way. Deliberate or reckless killing of civilians with the intention of communicating a political message. So it's a kind of mode of expression. There was a nice phrase in one of the American statutes saying that it's violence for other than mere personal monetary gain. So that was a nice insight into the way that the United States approaches violence and robbery. Well, this is mere personal monetary gain. I understand it completely. They're not just capitalists with a peculiarly minimalist approach to the state. Now, let me say something you might disagree with, and you can develop this in questions and answers if you want. I think sub-state actors who only do that kind of terrorism, I think that is always wrong. Now, I've qualified it, and I'll come back to the qualification. Sub-state actors who all they do is that, isolated killing of civilians intentionally or recklessly in order to communicate a political message. I think I can say that's immoral. There's an American scholar whom I think has written well on this subject, Walter LeCure, controversial kind of guy, and the experts on terrorism are, generally speaking, scary kind of guys. He calls terrorism the weapon of the weak. And I would sort of amend that and add a word. I think it's terrorism is the weapon of the weak bully. I'm weak, but I'm going to do something. I'm going to hurt somebody. Apart from the moral issue, which I'll now leave, I think there's three reasons why it's always wrong, which are practical or utilitarian. One, and I think that analysis of this kind of isolated subversive terrorism proves it time and time again, the method of communicating the message destroys the message. These guys start, let's say, with a very powerful grievance. They wish to communicate the grievance to a community that's not listening. They decide to kill a whole bunch of people, hijack an airplane, take a whole bunch of people hostage. And they're issuing their leaflets and they're giving their interviews to Charles Glass and so on and so forth, and they are communicating. Nobody's listening. Nobody gives a damn what the grievance is. They're all thinking, will that nice guy get out? Will they kill that person? And the method of communicating renders the message inaudible. Not many examples of the indiscriminate killing of civilians which has left intact the message that underpinned that violence. Secondly, I think such isolated actions by subversive groups are always counterproductive because they provoke such massive state reaction that the groups are themselves destroyed, and with it much of what they said they fought for. Now, this depends on how brutal the state is. The IRA was able to get away with quite a lot because, in a sense, the British government, despite what we say about them and so on, forbore from deploying the massive force that a less scrupulous, less democratically cultured government might have been tempted to do. A good example, however, from South America would be the so-called urban guerrillas, whose actions precipitated catastrophic counterterrorism in the 1960s by the state, leading to the deaths of tens of thousands, or rather, whose actions green-lighted and legitimized the desire on the part of some military to do this kind of thing. And I think you can look no further than Al-Qaeda for an example of a catastrophic act viewed even in terms of the goals of that group. And you see this latest message, which is the predictable plaintive call, why have you not all revolted, from an inverted commas bin Laden. Thirdly, such conduct is wrong because it destroys its own goals by making modest, peaceful agitation for the same ends almost impossible. The space for the articulation of a rational, radical, fair line on Northern Ireland was made tiny by the noise generated by what Conor Cruise O'Brien so memorably described as the politics of the last atrocity. The violence in the form of the Al-Qaeda violence makes a position of persons who take a fundamentalist but humane perspective on affairs very difficult to manage. There's no space in the discourse for them. Now, that's a critique of isolated acts of subversive violence, but that's not all that's caught by my language of terrorism. Because if you remember, my language was indiscriminate or reckless killing of individuals to communicate a political message. It did not say by groups of subversives acting in an isolated manner. But if my definition is right, then it follows, and this is a key point if I may say so, it follows that terrorism should be the noun that describes what those involved in political terror do. A terrorist, on this basis, is one who practices the technique of political terror. So the guys we've been talking about are terrorists in that sense. But there are other purveyors of political terror around as well. Terrorism is a type of violence, not a type of person. It's a methodology, not a group classification. It follows that it is a technique in international relations and or domestic politics which is capable of being used by any player on the political or international scene. It describes what people do, not what people are. Viewed from this perspective, terror as a tactic and terrorism as a description of that tactic can be seen as something available both to governments and to subversive groups. Political terror may be practiced right across the political spectrum, from right to left, from the isolated revolutionary, through the guerrilla group, the cessationist forces of a state. Now, in contrast to the terrorist, the terror will be just one method of attack among a variety available to be used. Hence the remark, terrorism is the weapon of the weak. The state can launch an orthodox war, it can launch a proxy attack by people who control territory, it can choose targeted smart bombs, or it can go with terrorism. The guerrilla likewise can control territory, mount quasi-army attacks, and deploy terror to attack civilians in order to achieve its goals via that form of political message. The terrorist, as we understand the term today, only does terror. But he or she is not the only one who does it. Now, on that analysis, it's perfectly clear to me that political leaders have been frequently guilty of terror. In fact, it's much easier to deploy political terror when you control a state. What better way would there be to communicate to the German people the futility of resistance than to arrange the blanket bombing and arbitrary killing of tens of thousands of them towards the end of a great war? What more effective means of communicating to the leadership of Japan that they should not resist American attempts to take the islands than to explode not one but two bombs on people who were known to be civilian, the purpose of which bombs was not to achieve a military success particularly, it was to say to other people, give up. Now, whereas I said earlier that I think isolated subversive terror acting on its own is invariably wrong, there is an open debate to be had about whether in the context of a wider conflict, the deployment of this particular kind of violence is always wrong. You need to judge it. You need to balance the options. You need to make calls of the difficult type that President Truman made or that Mr. Churchill made. The important point I'm trying to make is that you separate the action of engaging in terrorism from the judgment that because you have engaged in it, you have necessarily acted wrongly. The two are not the same. Yet for some reason, we have conflated them. We make war, well, the question is begged, is it just? We engage in a guerrilla action against a state, the question is begged, is that guerrilla action legitimate? We engage in terrorism, no question is begged, it's automatically wrong. We have conflated the description of the conduct with the judgment about its morality. Now there's a story about how that has happened. It's not a story we'll discuss here. Originally, terrorism was regarded as something that states did. The phrase is coined by and arises out of the French terror which followed the French Revolution. Somehow or other, it has insinuated itself into our vocabulary as a classification of person, a subversive, rather than a description of violence. There are, and I'm concluding with this, disastrous contemporary consequences of this. Firstly, the terrorist is now always a subversive, regardless of what he or she is seeking to subvert, whether or not it's a democratic government, or whether or not it's a dictatorship, or whether or not it's somewhere in the middle, a kind of casual authoritarian monolith. The terrorist, because the terrorist seeks to subvert it, is always wrong. Hence the embarrassment over, to pick an obvious example, Mr. Mandela, who was, for quite some time, a terrorist as that word has developed. And only some brisk, excellent Foreign Office maneuvering meant that he could cease to be one, and they bravely explained to Lady Thatcher why he no longer was one, and it was a bit embarrassing to continue to call him one. Secondly, and a very significant development, the terrorist, who's always subversive, regardless of who he opposes, is no longer only involved in indiscriminate killing of civilians. The language of terrorism, the definitions, have moved way beyond the gut perception of what terrorism is to encompass what comes close to dissent. That is not to say that people who dissent from the political system are locked up, but it is to say that they are exposing themselves to possible action by police against them. If you look at the definition of terrorism in the Terrorism Act 2000, you will not find a demand that there is any violence against innocent persons, nor will you find any restriction to this jurisdiction. Comes close to empowering the state to act against you in various ways, where you're involved in agitation outside the parameters set for you by the leaders of any country. May involve actions of violence, may even be a dramatic form of civil disobedience, a most worrying development. Thirdly, finally, not only is the terrorist always subversive, it follows in a bleak logical way that the forces of the established order, no matter how heinous, no matter how disproportionate in their response, are always the forces of the counter-terrorist. If the terrorist is always bad, because we've conflated the classification of the person with the conduct, it follows, as night follows day, that the counter-terrorist is always good. The blanket condemnation of the terrorist is matched by the blank check handed to the established order. No wonder it's a subject that governments throughout the world concentrate on, meet over, and are concerned by. It legitimizes their own conduct and delegitimizes those opposed to them, regardless sometimes of the iniquity of their regime, and regardless sometimes too of the nature of the way in which they oppose. In its modern form, therefore, the language of terrorism has become the rhetorical servant of the established order, whatever it might be, and however heinous its own activities are. Talking of terrorism in this way flattens the world of international relations, removes all subtle peaks and valleys that make up the real life of nations, and reduces the diplomatic map to a dull, lifeless plane on which are arrayed the huge armies of sovereign nations on one side and those who seek change on the other. Now, this is obviously, crassly ahistorical, depriving our own founding fathers and others of legitimacy. It is extremely dangerous. It is a route to the dismantling of the gains that the language of human rights achieved through its concentration on human dignity, representative democracy, and the rule of law. Thank you very much.
As Kate mentioned, I'm going to talk about the Anti-Terrorism, Crime and Security Act 2001, which to date is the main legal response that this country has given to the tragic events of September the 11th. I want to start by quoting three people. The first is a conservative legal theorist from Germany in the interwar period, Carl Schmitt, who said that sovereign is he who decides on the state of exception. In other words, that the sovereign is the one who decides on the nature of an emergency as well as on how to respond to it. This has been compared by David Deisenhaus, the legal philosopher, as being reminiscent of the view of Montesquieu that there are cases in which a veil should be drawn for a while over liberty, just as in ancient times it was customary to cover the statues of the gods. And the third person I'd like to quote from is, in our own time, David Panik, a well-known practitioner and writer, who gave a lecture after September the 11th on the question, do terrorists have human rights? And incurred the wrath of at least one government minister for answering that question yes. He said that a liberal democracy must confront the difficult question of what rights it should accord to those whose aim is to destroy the civilization which confers those very freedoms. Can Western society protect itself without abandoning the values which define its identity and so make it worth protecting? The topic I'd like to address is one which I believe presents the greatest challenge for the rule of law in this country at the present time, which is the detention without trial of people who are suspected of being international terrorists. In July of last year, the Special Immigration Appeals Commission, SIAC for short, considered the issue of the lawfulness of the UK's derogation from Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And subsequently, in October of last year, the Court of Appeal heard the appeal by the government against their decision. I'll come back to those particular decisions in due course. The measures which require a derogation from the convention are contained in Part 4 of the Anti-Terrorism Act, in particular Section 23, which allows the Secretary of State, the Home Secretary, on a certificate issued by the executive, to detain a person who is suspected of being an international terrorist. And a theme I'll come back to at the end is that when one analyzes that, in substance, what that means is that the government of the day can send someone to prison indefinitely without the inconvenience of a trial and a conviction. That's what it's about. In my view, the derogation is incompatible with the convention and unlawful under the Human Rights Act for three reasons. The first is that the government has failed to demonstrate that there exists, in the words of Article 15 of the convention, a public emergency threatening the life of the nation. Those are important words. Not just an emergency, but one threatening the life of the nation. Even if that were wrong, the second reason is that the derogation measures go beyond what Article 15 permits, namely measures which are strictly required by the exigencies of the situation. Strictly required. And the third reason is that the derogation violates another rule of international law, which is the principle of equality, or the prohibition on discrimination, in particular because it discriminates as between British citizens and foreign nationals. It's only foreign nationals who can be detained without trial. Now, SIAC rejected the first of those arguments. It accepted that there was a public emergency. It accepted the argument that there was discrimination, and for that reason it also held that the measures were not strictly required, because to be strictly required, the government would have had to extend them to all or to none. The background is that after September the 11th, the government asked Parliament to rush through the legislation in question, and the problem it confronted was the earlier case law of the European Court of Human Rights had held that you could not deport someone on the grounds of national security if to return them to their own state would put them at risk of torture in breach of Article 3. Article 3, as many of you will know, is an absolute right. And so it was impossible under the convention to return people where they would face torture. And that's important background to the emergency legislation for reasons that will become clear later, I hope. The first question that I've mentioned, where is there a public emergency, is not one I want to dwell on tonight, partly for reasons of time, but partly because, as I've mentioned, SIAC accepted the government's evidence that there was a public emergency threatening the life of the nation. The only thing I would draw attention to is that the reasons which are given in the derogation sent to Strasbourg by the UK government for saying that there is an emergency threatening the life of the UK are all reasons of a very general character. They could have been given by most West European states, at least, because those reasons are confined, in essence, to the attacks of September the 11th. And yet, no other member of the Council of Europe has felt it necessary to derogate from the convention. So the UK is one of only about 43 states which has felt it necessary to derogate and to detain without trial. I want to concentrate, however, on the second and third of the questions that I've referred to, because what I would suggest these help to understand is that even in this area, even in this sensitive area of a public emergency, if one accepts that there is one, it is still possible for the law to have something useful to say. And that's why I would reject the quotation I started with, Schmitt's, that there comes a point, effectively, when law runs out and all you have is the government saying, we have to do this, there is nothing else that can be done. That, to my mind, is to abdicate the role of law as well as the rule of law and to resign oneself to the fact that all there is, ultimately, is brute force. I reject that. And one of the reasons I reject that is that it is possible to ask relevant legal questions without usurping the role of the government in protecting the lives of all of us. If one asks, for example, are the measures strictly required to meet the emergency? Well, the emergency is said to be the attack by Al-Qaeda of September the 11th. And yet, the measures which can be taken under the detention provisions can be directed to anyone who is liable to deportation. In other words, you might be a member of the Tamil Tigers you might pose no threat at all to the UK's national security, and yet, under this legislation, you can be detained without trial. Now, this is often called in constitutional adjudication the doctrine of overbreadth. In other words, the legislation on its face is overbroad, because if the emergency is X, but in fact you take powers which would meet X, Y, and Z, why are you hitting Y and Z? This is a relevant legal question. Now, the way in which the courts have answered this to date is to say that this is all very interesting, but if the only people in fact being detained are associated with Al-Qaeda, then it is an academic question. So the legislation on its face may be overbroad and obviously inconsistent with human rights, but the courts say we're not going to answer this question because you're not entitled to raise it. Somebody else might be. And the other way in which they've responded is even more extraordinary. They've relied on assurances given by the Attorney General to them in court, saying that whatever the legislation passed by Parliament may say, the government would not, in fact, detain people who are not associated with Al-Qaeda. What does this mean for those of us who believe in the rule of law? One element of which is that Parliament, democratically accountable, should not go around passing laws which don't mean what they say. So you have to rely on executive assurances being given to the courts that the law will not in fact be used as on its face it could be used. That's the doctrine of overbreadth. Another doctrine which constitutional lawyers in other jurisdictions would use to challenge this kind of legislation, but which I regret to say so far at least the courts of this country do not seem to understand, is the doctrine of under-inclusive legislation. In fact, the Court of Appeal so failed to understand this argument that when Liberty made this argument to them, Lord Wolfe, the Lord Chief Justice, described it as paradoxical. The argument goes like this, that to be strictly required to meet X, a measure should hit the whole of X and not just a part of it. So if you use the archery analogy, you try and hit the target as a whole and not just one corner of it. Why? Because it can't be said to be required, strictly required, if all you're doing is only partially effective. The danger with under-inclusive legislation is that when you actually scrutinize which part of the target the government is hitting, lo and behold, you find that it has entered the arena of society and chosen arbitrarily to whom the legislation will apply. If you make that more concrete in the present context, if you imagine the Home Secretary going to the British people and saying, we have such a grave crisis in this country that every one of you, 60 million people, British citizens and everyone, is going to be liable to be locked up indefinitely on my say-so, we can imagine what kind of reaction that there might be to that suggestion. That's not what the government did. The government says, we have this grave crisis. In order to meet it, we're going to lock up foreigners. So the rest of you don't need to worry. Don't worry, because these are relatively unpopular people. They all look like Osama bin Laden anyway. Nobody really cares. How often now in your newspapers do you read about the facts of the detainees? They've been in prison for over a year in maximum security. People don't know who they are. People don't know what organizations they purport to support or not support. They don't know whether they deny the allegations against them or whether they accept them and are proud of them. It's not news. I imagine it would have been news if everyone were liable to this emergency legislation. And that leads on to the third of the reasons why this is all unlawful, in my view, under the Human Rights Act. It's related to that point about under-inclusiveness, and it is that it violates the principle of equality. One of the most important words in the European Convention on Human Rights is the word everyone. This is historically a modern innovation. It dates really from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is barely 50 years old. Of course, the people who wrote human rights instruments at the end of the Second World War were usually themselves the masters of colonial powers. Historically, the West did not believe in universal human rights. It is now said to be a Western value. They didn't believe in it. They could only justify holding down empires on the basis that some in humanity are more equal than others. And yet, somehow, the spirit of equality has come through and survived, and it's there to be found in words like everyone. Everyone has the right to liberty. Not just those that you favor, not just those who are your own nationals. One of the problems with the legislation which derogates from the convention is that it discriminates on the ground of nationality, because British citizens, by definition, cannot be deported. And what the government has done and Parliament has endorsed is that in form the 2001 legislation is a piece of immigration law. And this is a wonderful sleight of hand, because the very people who are liable to be detained without trial are people, it's written down in the legislation, who cannot be deported, because to deport them would be subjecting them to torture in their home countries. And you may think that what's going on here is actually quite interesting, that this is nothing to do with September the 11th, but everything to do with earlier inconvenient decisions of the European Court of Human Rights, which had said that Article 3 would be violated if you return someone to their home country where there's a risk of torture. You can't get around that directly, and so you've got on your territory people who are possibly nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. The leading case, in fact, concerned a Sikh. Chahal was suspected of being a terrorist in India. And these people can't be deported for legal reasons. So what the legislation says is that these people, who by definition cannot be deported, can, however, be detained. Why? Because you intend to deport them, even though you can't. Now, the Court of Appeal said this is all right, because you're not discriminating, because these two groups of people are not in a comparable situation. What does that mean? What they say is that because British citizens can't be deported by definition, they're not in a comparable position to foreign nationals who can be deported, forgetting that the class that we're actually talking about have been defined by Parliament to be the very class who cannot be deported for legal reasons. I would say there is in law no relevant distinction. You've got a class of citizens who can't be deported for legal reasons. You've got a class of foreign nationals who can't be deported for legal reasons. The Court of Appeal says that because a foreign national does not have the right to live in this country, what follows? Apparently it follows that it means that they have no other rights either. They don't have the right to a fair trial. So the government can, as I said earlier, send them to prison on suspicion of being an international terrorist without the inconvenience of a trial and a conviction. I want to end with a quotation from an American judge, Justice Jackson, who was in fact ironically quoted by Lord Wolfe in his judgment in the detention without trial case. Liberty had shown this authority, this case, to the court, and so it was quite pleased when it read to page 5 of the judgment that this was in fact being quoted with approval. Unfortunately, in my view, the court then fails to follow the spirit of this sentiment. Let me read it first and end with some comments on it. Justice Jackson, who some of you may know was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, and also a justice of the US Supreme Court, said in a case in 1948 that equality is not merely abstract justice. The framers of the Constitution knew, and we should not forget, that there is no more effective guarantee against arbitrary government than to require that the principles of law which officials would impose upon a minority must be imposed generally. Conversely, nothing opens the door to arbitrary action so effectively as to allow those officials to pick and choose only a few to whom they will apply legislation, and thus, and these are very important words, thus to escape the political retribution that might be visited upon them if larger numbers were affected. And he finished in this way: courts can take no better measure to assure that laws will be just than to require that laws be equal. What does that mean for us in the context of the anti-terrorism legislation? I think what it means is that there is a perfectly tenable position that lawyers can take, those who are interested in human rights can take, that in spite of the sensitive nature of an emergency, it is still possible for law to have something to say. This is not just about force and abdicating resort to law completely. And one of the things that law can say in a democracy is that the law will not tell the government of the day how to run the country. The law will not say to the government, you cannot have this policy. We accept, for the sake of argument, that there is an emergency, and we accept that you have to do something to protect the British people to meet it. But what you can't do is pick and choose a few to whom you will apply the law, knowing that thereby you escape the political retribution which would probably ensue if you said to the entire citizenry, this is what we're going to do to all of you. And that's perfectly consistent with a democratic theory of human rights, because that is not about the courts, unelected as they are, saying to the elected government, we are going to impose this policy on you. But it is to say, we send it back to the democratic arena, and it's up to the democratically elected parliament to say whether it really wants to extend this legislation to everyone. If it does, well, liberty would regret that, but so be it. But I suspect that in practice, that if that had been the nature of the question asked, people in this country would not have been so willing to countenance detention without trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Because of our excellent timekeeping, my speakers, we've got plenty of time for questions and comments. I should just mention before we do that that both the papers will be on the Centre's website from tomorrow, so that you can access them. What I suggest is that we take three or four questions together. Are you happy for that? If you could please say who you are and where you're from, and if you could keep your questions or comments as short as possible so that as many people can contribute, that would be helpful. There should be some roving mics, I think, both top and bottom. Do you want to grab a there's no one at the back can hear about it.
I feel like a bit like Elvis. Hi. You were talking about definitions, and you said it's important to know what we mean by human rights. And towards the end of your talk, you were talking about terrorism, and you were talking about the use of language. Is not part of the problem, you know, the fact that we've actually used the word terrorism tonight here? And if indeed, if you intend to do a particular course on this sort of topic, a better term might be the use of political violence. And then within that title, you can look at the various subcategories.
Let me pick up a couple more and then we can draw them together. Over here.
Hi, I'm Lars. I'm doing nothing. I was just wondering about the message of terrorism, because I think, strangely enough, America actually listened to the 11th of September, and for the first time they are thinking about people in Palestine, and Israel for the first time got some trouble from America. So I think, in a way, the message in that case arrived.
Can I have a question from the top? Is there? It's coming round.
Thank you. I'm an overseas doctor, so naturally deprived of human rights. So I'm immensely pleased to see the Kate Winslet and the Leonardo O'Hartley of the human rights. The question is to my Indian friend, Mr. Singh. The storm is gathering. The super salutes of the shoulder to shoulder are very itching to wage a war against the Iraq. Is there a way that you could approach the ICC and persuade the judges that these two, I mean, the state sponsored terrorist has to execute a bond, so that in the aftermath, this fund could be used for the reconstruction, not only for the reconstruction of Iraq, but also for the treatment of Gulf War syndrome. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm conscious that we ought to allow lots of time for questions, so I will expect to be quite brief. First, Stephen, you know, you're dead right, and all I can answer for you saying is that Fred Halliday wrote a terrific book, a colleague of ours here at the LSE and a tremendous friend of the center who got it going, a tremendous professor of international relations. He wrote a book after 11 September, and there's a little bit in it saying some people don't want to use the language of terrorism at all, you know, footnote me, you know, see for one of these eccentrics, but it's impossible. And I racked my brains for an appropriate description, and I wrote a whole book on terrorism without mentioning terrorism, but you know, life is short, you know, I mean, I'll just be thought of, it'll be the bloke over there, isn't he weird, you know. But we're looking for another word and we haven't found it yet. And political violence is difficult to say, and what are they? People who do political violence in isolation. Takes a long time, you know. Secondly, I just disagree on the Israeli point. Anybody who saw the interview given by Mr. Sharon, the current Prime Minister of Israel, you know, with his insults towards Europe and his total confidence in the American line, and compare that with what Rumsfeld, the Defense Secretary, said, you know, what he thought about was nuclear attack, you know. So a certain message got through. I don't think it was a message about the plight of the Islamic or the Middle Eastern people, or the need to redress the global inequality of power, to be honest, really. Thirdly, and this is mainly, I think, aimed at Ravinder, the excellent question about the ICC. I was very struck, and I'll only say this, and then we'll see what Ravinder has to say, by a contrast in this country. This bloke was holed up, I think is a relevant cliche, in a flat in Hackney. And his one demand was that he should not be subjected to the criminal process. And that was simply the only demand the police cannot deliver. And you just think to yourself, well, actually, that's kind of the paradigm to work towards, where it's just unthinkable that people engaged in serious criminality can buy immunity by being inconvenient. But I think we're some way from that idealistic goal. There may be hypocrisy, there may be double standards, there may be judgment calls on the way, but we're going there. And when it's as unacceptable to kill people because you happen to be a leader as it is unacceptable to kill people when you happen to be a regular guy in a state, then we've reached a true human rights situation in the world as a whole.
Just on the last of those questions first, as I understand it, the ICC's jurisdiction has not been accepted either by Iraq or the United States, so those countries will not be subject to this new jurisdiction. But interestingly enough and importantly, the United Kingdom, of course, has accepted it. And so if there is war against Iraq in the next few months, this will be the first war in history where British troops and politicians are going to be subject to the jurisdiction of an international criminal court, and in theory, at least, answerable for their actions to international law. On the first question, the definitions are difficult, but of course, those of us who are lawyers, at least, all the time have to deal with definitions. And what's interesting, I think, in the present context is how far what Connor said earlier about the misuse of language has gone. Because in official language, by which I mean legislation, state-sanctioned language, if you like,
there is now misuse of language of the type that he refers to going on in the name of the British people. And there hasn't been time so far today to go into the definition of terrorism in the 2000 Act. The 2000 Act, that was passed before the so-called emergency. And Connor's absolutely right. That is not confined to violence as conventionally understood. For example, if you disrupt seriously a computer system, that can be terrorism. If you target military targets only, that can be terrorism. If you target only the military of an overseas dictatorial regime, that can be terrorism. And the reason why this is a problem for us is that under the 2000 Act, organizations, wherever they may be in the world, can now be banned by the British government. It means that, for example, if you display a poster here supporting a banned organization or wear a t-shirt supporting a banned organization, it doesn't matter whether you've engaged in violence or not. As a supporter, you are committing a criminal offense. And Connor is absolutely right. If the ANC had been subject to this legal regime, it could be banned. And those of us who spent all those years in the anti-apartheid movement, Peter Hain and the like, could be committing criminal offenses now. And this is really quite extraordinary.
Take another few questions. Over here.
I want, it's, sorry, it's Alvise Armellini, LAC, from the European Politics and Policy Program. And I wanted to ask a question about the ICC. Professor Conor Gearty mentioned that point about skeptic people being right-wing, and there was a passing comment about the skeptics doubting whether the ICC could be useful in judging Saddam. And I just wanted to ask in sort of absolute layman terms, because I don't know very much about it, but I was watching this documentary on the fall of Milosevic on the BBC on Sunday, and it showed how Milosevic was deported to The Hague going against the will of a democratic elected president of Serbia and going against the rule of law of the Serbian country. And since the rule of law constituted one of the sort of preconditions of human rights, what kind of rule of law do you follow in an international court of justice? What do you do when, say, the people of a single country refuse to, say, the Iranian people, the Iraqi people didn't want to give up Saddam? What happened in Serbia is that that Milosevic got handed over because the U.S. kind of blackmailed Serbia and didn't want to hand him over because otherwise they would have stopped economic aid. So I just wanted to sort of ask about that. Thank you.
Yes, my question is for Professor Gearty. My name is Elan. I'm an international relations student here. Your description, I guess, of the human rights regime, the three points that you made about dignity, representative democracy, and rule of law, they echo a lot of John Rawls's arguments about ethics and responsibility and also international relations. But I'm concerned because I don't quite see how those three, or how that, I guess a trilogy, if you will actually ensure that which you're trying to provide. And specifically, I don't see exactly how we can conceptualize a concept of responsibility within that will view ethics towards the other as something that we have to follow. That sort of, or to put it differently, I don't understand, to paraphrase, to paraphrase the writings of Emmanuel Levinas, exactly how the insurance against evil. Where is the insurance against evil in that conception?
One more.
Thank you very much, speakers, for the very, very insightful talk. My name is Ruchira Goswami. I'm a student in the human rights course. My question is, might sound a little naive. Can the human rights language suggest any effective steps to stop the cycle of violence, namely terrorism, both by the state and the subversive groups? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, I'll try and be quite brief in order to free up some more space. On the criminal court, I think I haven't got a great deal more to say because I'm not an international lawyer and I'm no expert in it. I think Saddam, if he chooses asylum, would be careful not to take Surrey or Belgium. So I think that I'm sure Ravinder's right about where he can go. I'm a bit of an idealist about international law. I think we're moving from a national to an international paradigm, and the analogy I would draw might be where there's a kind of gang leader in an area who has it all intimidated and in terror, and he kills a whole bunch of them and so on. And he's in a community, in a nation. It's unthinkable to us that we would think that he could in any way claim exemption because of his, should we say, spurious kind of leadership, or because of some sort of spurious, intimidated support that the community has for him. Or we would be quite confident to condemn it as a kind of false consciousness. Now, we're not there yet, and it does sound like a very supercilious attitude to certain national entities, but we're moving in the direction of an international perspective on evil. I think that's a good thing. On the justice, well, I mean, we've seen Milosevic seem to almost settle into a new life as a kind of defendant, as a kind of new activity. And there might be some people who might regard this as I don't know what Rabindra's analysis will be, overbroad or underbroad, or one of them anyway. I mean, the degree to which he's given fair play. So I think the concentration should be on the fairness of the procedures, and we seem certainly to have that. On the very interesting remarks, I was, of course, thrilled that there was even an echo of John Rawls. But you've raised a very important point, because I don't believe that there is any insurance against evil. And this is where I'm a bit kind of a part ways with the guys who rack their brains to produce the ethical approach. And they go to seminars and they work out what the ethical approach is, and they talk to each other, and they're all fantastic brainy, and they've gone to the best schools and so on, and they come up with the answer. But the world is passing them by. And they think that somehow or other coming up with the answer, as it were, now they have the internet, they put it on it, and everything stops. But no, I don't believe there is any insurance against evil, just as I don't believe that these three kind of ideas which center on the notion of human rights will provide that. What it provides for me is much less ambitious but more credible in my view, which is a framework for struggle. Professor Keith Ewing and I wrote a book about civil liberties, and we called it, after a great deal of thought, The Struggle for Civil Liberties. So I don't see there being any way in which you can get up, declare your position, and then through the brilliance of your intellect, sit down and expect everybody to follow it. You should fight, you should protest, you should complain, you should energize others. That's the route. Less worry about whether you're right and more determination to ensure that what you believe happens, seems to me. Finally, I must praise, of course, our students on the MSc, a characteristically thoughtful but modest intervention, pretending to be naive, because we train all our students in humility as well at the Center for the Study of Human Rights. I mean, it's a key issue, about human rights futures. The more I look at the convention, the more sophisticated I think that document is. Now, it's a surprising thing to say, and I'm being perfectly honest, and I didn't say it in the past. It incorporates an intelligent approach to national security by framing it as international personal security and national personal security. And it does so in a sophisticated way. This derogation business to which Rabindra was referring, you're allowed derogate, but you're not allowed to continue to torture or take life other than in the context of lawful conflict under cover of the derogation. So there is within the convention and the language of human rights an understanding of the need to connect human rights to persons' survival within geographic entities known as states. The key thing for the human rights people is to recognize that and articulate it, and not to run scared when arguments about national security are raised in opposition to them. This is where a chance to do it. I would echo Rabindra's deep critique of the judiciary here, where they kind of, in a sense, run scared once the language of national security is presented. They dash off the stage. They're not supposed to do that, and human rights doesn't require them to do that, but nor does it require them, in the words of Lord Wolfe, to collude in a suicide pact. The Human Rights Act is not a suicide pact. It's a mechanism for having both security and respect for each other as persons.
You said that your position may have been naive. I think I've been described in my submissions in court in the last 6 months as being utopian.
And I have to say, I'm not ashamed of that, because I think that at bottom, a belief in human rights is relatively innovative in human society and profoundly radical, and reflects a faith in the human spirit, which is not necessarily justified by experience. But nevertheless, some of us have it. I think that it is as good an assurance against evil as there is possible in the world. To make that slightly less abstract, I think that if we take, say, this principle of equality, it's very important, because the opposite of equality is double standards. I think that phrase is something that ordinary people around the world understand. And I think one of the running sores in our world is a feeling that there are double standards applied. There are double standards when it comes to using the rhetoric of human rights. So if it's a country with which we wish to do business, we tend to soft pedal on human rights rhetoric. If it's a country where we need to have air force bases, we tend to overlook the systematic abuse of human rights in that country. But if it's a country where we don't like the regime, then we accuse it of violating international law and not respecting human rights. And I think that one of the antidotes to the cycle of violence is to try and meet that underlying sense of grievance. I don't think that you could miraculously cure the world's problems that way. But at least we could, as a community, face the world's problems in a sincere way, genuinely committed to these ideals, and not let this cynicism take hold, that actually this all this is the veneer of rhetoric.
We've probably got time for a couple more. There's one up the back there.
Sorry, I got a bit of a sore throat. I'd like to ask Conor Gearty about his remark about representative democracy and how he thought it was totally in keeping with human rights, and especially when all of the discussion about the European Convention of Human Rights and the 2001 Act seems to many people to suggest that, you know, representative democracy has proved to be in opposition. I think it would be a shame to sort of just define representative democracy in a way which, you know, something that we like, and therefore anything that we don't like is in opposition to it, because I think that's probably the central problem of the Act.
Pursuing our equality theme, it would be nice to have another female voice. You know, terrorism isn't just for boys.
Following from the previous question, perhaps another naive question as well is, who will be the next defenders of human rights when we're coming across the dichotomy of us and them, of terrorism and counterterrorism, where you don't know where the us begins and the them started? And if that is the scenario of conflict that we find ourselves in today, and the fighting means are basically the same, what will happen in this period of which will eventually come, of post-conflict reconstruction? Where will we be? With what legitimacy? And who will be immune to this process of conflict with enough value to be the next defenders of human rights, if there are still human rights to defend in that sense? Thank you.
Well, first question, of course, correctly identifies a tension, because I both declare representative democracy to be one of the elements of human rights, and then I excoriate the relevant leaders in the fashion that I did. Is there a contradiction? Well, I remind you of my model of the subject, which is that there's no ethical absolutism, there's all this struggle. So that, in a sense, you fight within the representative framework, and like Rabindra, I'm also kind of utopian idealist. You fight and fight and fight. You don't win all the time. Part of my anxiety about the language of human rights when it's presented in ethically absolute terms is it is not equipped to enter into that battleground.
And so it crumbles at the first whiff of grape shot and disappears and is easily trampled over, because in fact it's not equipped to fight. So the answer I would give to you, which you may want to pick up with me in questions and answers afterwards, is that actually the 2001 Act was sharply moderated by a recognition of human rights issues in the parliamentary process. And if you don't think that, have a look at the relevant reports of the Joint Committee on Human Rights, and have a look at the powerful report by the Home Affairs Committee, chaired by Chris Mullen. Now, it's not perfect. Perfection would have been repeal or non-enactment of this measure. But you go into the battleground of politics, and you argue the case. There's a committee of privy councillors currently reviewing whether to maintain in the statute book these detention provisions. They've made a call for evidence. People have given evidence to them. The issues rehearsed by Rabinder here have been rehearsed before them. There is, in other words, a political process. This can be seen off if there's energy on the part of the people. That's why Rabinder's point about including the British would be the way of kind of, in a sense, bringing it home to us all and energizing us. But we can still do that. We can still do that. We're still a relatively open democratic society. So that's an unsatisfactory, messy, because not ethically pure answer. The second question, I must say the naivety and modesty of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights is getting out of control, because she didn't even reveal that she was a member of the MSc class. So they're now seeking complete anonymity. So modest are they. Well, just two names. I can't remember the name of the second guy. Where are the next defenders of human rights coming from? Would you be surprised? Every now and again, somebody stands up and they point something out, and then people notice, and other people notice, and it gathers momentum. This McCarthyism was vindicated and legitimized by the American Supreme Court in a case called Dennis in the United States, when it could have been brought down. It's fine, they said, no invasion of free speech that we need to address. But it was people in the media, Ed Murrow in particular. It was people in the Senate, one or two of them initially. It was people brave enough to challenge McCarthy that eventually caused people to see, my God, this is outrageous. And the process has begun in America. A Republican governor, last few days in office, thinks we're killing all these people who were innocent. And even if they're not innocent, the procedures have been so profoundly flawed, I cannot have in my conscience that they are going to die. And this most unlikely person in this peculiar part of the United States says, hey. And people notice. You never know where these defenders are going to come from. What we mustn't do is slip into a kind of apathetic cynicism which says it's always bound to get worse. It's not. And you'd never know, at the worst point, it may be just about to get, in the words of the 1997 campaign music, going to get better. New Labour clone that I am.
Just a couple of observations briefly to end, perhaps. The first is to echo what Connor and I, I think, have said in the past, that the Human Rights Act is a democratic Bill of Rights. That's how it's been constructed. And so many of the legal arguments, for example, that I've been outlining tonight, are precisely arguments which put the debate back into the political arena. They make the democratically accountable government and legislature address the right questions, but they don't subvert democracy, representative democracy. They force democracy to live up to its own ethics and rhetoric, and I think that's valuable. The second is, I think, perhaps to reduce it, I hope not inappropriately, to a very personal level. I think each of us had a personal reaction to September the 11th. Mine, I have to say, was very different from the likes of our political leaders, because to me, it was a moment to reflect on why it's so important to recommit ourselves to human rights. Because if you think about it, what happened on that day was an obscene violation of people's human rights. It was an attack on civilians, innocent people, with whom, if we believe in the sorts of things that Connor started this evening with whom we should have human empathy. But what do we then do in order to respond to those who attack our very core values? I think our response has to be to reaffirm our commitment to human rights and say, we will not reduce ourselves to the level of those who are prepared to commit such atrocities. Sometimes it's said that the language of human rights is about mutuality. In other words, that I respect other people's rights because they should respect my rights. I'm not sure that's actually right, because I think sometimes we face a situation in the world where we know that the person whose rights we say we should respect, if they had the choice, would kill us.
they would be prepared to torture us. But if we know ourselves and what we stand for, then I think we have to say, no matter what, we will not engage in torture. We will not kill someone who has their hands tied behind their backs and can't fight back.
I think we've run out of time, and I'm sure we can carry on discussing these issues over a drink in the Robbins Room. And I'd just like to ask you to join me in thanking our speakers for their excellent talk.